The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour this Monday, April 23rd. I am Carolyn Yeager, with you for the next 2 hours, broadcasting live from Voice of Reason Network. I have a packed program for you tonight, all about the Jewish Great Deportation, which is what I once claimed I was always going to call it, otherwise known as the Holocaust. And rightly so, as we are here in the United States just completing the Days of Remembrance for this event. You didn't know that? Well, I had forgotten too, actually. But today I saw in the news that President Barack Obama toured the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., at the behest of and being led, once again, by his pal, Elie Wiesel. After which, Obama warned Syria and Iran, which Wiesel certainly had something to do with. Those who think Wiesel is just a foolish old man, excuse me, who talks nonsense, well, that's not quite the way it is. I will remind you that the Days of Remembrance, I was checking this out. It's so interesting, I have to include this before I start my reading. The Days of Remembrance is our national annual commemoration of the Holocaust in accordance with a congressional mandate that also created the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum as a permanent living memorial to the victims. Why Americans have to provide and pay for this permanent living memorial to a European event is the question. But the answer is easy. The Jews in America want it, and what the Jews want, they get. Let me tell you a little about it. The Holocaust Remembrance Day this year was Thursday, April 19th, last Thursday. But it runs for a week from the Sunday before Holocaust Remembrance Day, which has a name. It's called Yom HaShoah. So the Sunday before that, I bet you didn't know that that day is Yom HaShoah for all Americans. Has that HaShoah, Shoah, isn't it cute? Whatever it means, something about the Shoah. Through the following Sunday, it runs from that Sunday through yesterday. And you can view these dates by going to the Remembrance Day calendar at the Holocaust Museum website. They have a calendar for all these events. And one day we will be learning these events. We will be learning this calendar and the names of these days in kindergarten, and all our young children will have all this memorized. We'll know exactly all these Hebrew names and Yiddish words and special days of remembrance. So, but they also tell us that these days of remembrance are observed by state and local governments, military bases, workplaces, schools, churches, synagogues, and civic centers. And since 1982, the museum has organized and led the National Days of Remembrance ceremony in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda with Holocaust survivors, liberators, members of Congress, White House officials, the diplomatic corps, and community leaders in attendance. Well, realize that when the Jews write this stuff up, they do make it all that they can make it out to be. I'm sure that not every state and local government, certainly not workplaces and not military bases, observe these days, but you know, they are allowed to do so if they want to. So I just have a little comment here. All this is done to keep alive the big lie of a Holocaust in spite of no evidence. Now, you know, what a country we live in that does things like this. And we might as well all go to Israel pretty soon it'll be the same. Now, to go to the real Holocaust, I'm going to read tonight in The Fire from Chapter 3. I better get started. This is in the section called The West, the industrialized built-up area along the Rhine River, of which Cologne is probably the most recognizable name. I have a couple of videos on my website, carolynyeager.com, about the bombing of Cologne, which you might want to, if you're ever there, you might look for them. I'm on page 205, and I want to confess that I do this reading without very good light, which is, every time I start, I think, well, I need to get a desk lamp on here to give myself better light. I would probably read better if I had better light, but I do manage to, I can see it, so here I go. The West. The Rhine is Europe's north-south axis. It is the shortest route for travel between the Mediterranean realm and the north, and Caesar set this line as the base camp from where it was possible to dominate the forested depths as far as the Weser and the Elbe. Based on this view, the banks of the Rhine are the dividing line. People either turn their backs to the river or they face it and secure their crossing. From another perspective, the banks are a unit connecting the areas to the right and left into a separate land between Germany and Gaul. This is the Rhineland. This intermediary realm was called Lotharingia during the Carolingian partition of the empire. Further south, it was Burgundy. Later, it was two versions of the Confederation of the Rhine, and then, to a certain extent, the Federal Republic governed from Bonn. Skipping a couple sentences, the battles for the river were fought mostly in the foothills, except for the exterminating battle, the bombardment of Rhine cities during the World War II. It began in 1940 with the fall of Rotterdam. To that extent, coinciding with England's Rhine policies through the centuries, lying on the coast opposite the mouth of the Rhine, England was always interested in seeing that no single power dominate the Rhine, especially not at the Delta, whether that power was named Napoleon or Hitler. And so the air war was started as a war of the Rhine, and it also ended that way. That means that the first bombing was along the Rhine, and this air war started there, and it ended there to some extent, basically. 23 cities from Emmerich to Breisach were heavily bombed. Emmerich, Ries, Xanten, Wesel, Dinslaken, Krefeld, Duisburg, Dusseldorf, Neuss, Leverkusen, Cologne, Bonn, Koblenz, Rüdesheim, it would be, Bingen, Mainz, Wiesbaden, Worms, Mannheim, Ludwigshafen, Karlsruhe, Kehl, and Breisach. Those are all some of the 23 cities that he says not until their destruction did the Rhine cities totally share the fate of a country from which they never had much to gain. Prior to 1870, they had been Austrians, Württembergers, Badeners, Bavarians, Hessians, Nassauers, Dutch, even Prussians. Most of the time, the Rhine belonged not to one country, but to many, and mostly to the band of its cities. Well, now I'm going to move a couple pages to get into the actual bombing. I'm starting with the city of Duisburg. Duisburg was bombed 299 times during World War II, an average of once a week. The horror intensified as the intervals became shorter. In July 1942, three major raids took place at two-day intervals, and on October 13, 1944, Arthur Harris received the directive for Operation Hurricane. And here's a quote. In order to demonstrate to the enemy in Germany generally the overwhelming superiority of the Allied air forces in this theater, the intention is to apply within the shortest practical period the maximum effort of the Royal Air Force Bomber Command and the 8th United States Bomber Command against objectives in the densely populated Ruhr. Unquote. And he asks, why densely populated? Well, he says Duisburg offered military targets like Norther City in Germany. One third of the German iron and steel was produced there. In Wedau, it had the country's second largest marshalling yard. Its river port supplied the entire Rhine-Ruhr region, and it had a host of shipyards, large coking plants, and coal mines. It was the westernmost industrial location in the Ruhr Basin, a stretched-out, long, and narrow city, perfectly situated within OBOS, that's their radar, British radar system, precision radius. And I'm going to skip again and read about the Operation Hurricane on October 14th and 15th, 1944. This is the city of Duisburg, very important city, close to Cologne. In the 240th raid, 240th, ladies and gentlemen, the city was toppled as if a tornado had struck. In all previous raids combined, 1,576 people had been killed, a ratio of only 0.36%, a first-class air raid protection achievement. This protection consisted of 37 above-ground tower bunkers. That, just think, 37 above-ground tower bunkers. Those were great types of bunkers. And two underground bunkers, as well as 53 mine-like tunnels that had been dug into slag heaps. Operation Hurricane started on Saturday morning at 8:45. In 20 minutes, 1,063 British planes dropped 3,574 tons of high-explosive bombs and 820 tons of incendiaries. This was on the order of Hamburg, but the city had one-fourth of Hamburg's population. That means it was about the same as what they dropped on Hamburg, but being only one-fourth the size. A second and third raid followed that night. At around 1:30 in the morning on Sunday, 1,005 planes appeared. And at 4 a.m. came the third wave, dropping a total of 4,500 tons of munitions. The three attacks on Duisburg dropped 1.5 times the total bomb tonnage of the war to date. And this was October 1944 of these raids. The city had to endure 9,000 tons of bombs over 20 hours. No other city in Germany suffered that. Hurricane took 3,000 human lives, more than half the total Duisburg casualties of 5,730. The map of damages showed only isolated areas as having been left untouched. The 9,000-ton series was continued 2 weeks later in Cologne, a city almost double the size of Duisburg and spanning both sides of the Rhine. The purpose of the raid suggested a post-hurricane. Between October 27th and November 1st, we're in 44, a total of 1,900 bombers dropped 9,000 tons. British military historian J.F.C. Fuller wrote that so many planes were being produced that their use had become irresistible, and bombs even rained down on Cologne's rubble heaps. The RAF bombers were crowding each other so closely that there seemed more danger of a collision than being hit by flak. Well, there wasn't a whole lot of flak left by then, but mostly the flak was gone later in 45, after February 45, I guess. So now I'm going to move ahead. Again, I'm doing a lot of trying to get a few different cities in tonight because I'm only going to do the West on this one night. So now I'm at here, about Cologne. It's about the... Okay, I start here. The first bombing raids in May and June 1940, this is Cologne, also called a Köln in German, lured thousands of curious onlookers to the destroyed buildings. Because remember, this is, I said, 1940. These are the very first raids in 1940. There were six deaths. It was like a car crash, or like a crash scene, but in a war. In 1941, there were nonstop light and medium-sized attacks, a constant rain that killed a total of 185 by April 1942. The mouth of the Schelde served as a landmark for bomber command. The estuary was a huge distributor with branches leading throughout all of Germany's city landscape. For lost pilots, however, it was the nightly bright band of the Rhine that pointed the way westward, northward to the sea. Many routes passed over Cologne, which airmen, either coming or going, used as a disposal site for surplus bombs. The alarms were certainly not sounded for those, or else the 768,000 people would have lived in a constant state of alarm. The 1,000-bomb raid marked the way into the world of the Battle of the Huns. Even the hosts of angels were present. Previously, only the myth could have depicted the 2.5-mile-long wall of exploding anti-aircraft artillery set for sustained fire, the searchlight cones scanning the sky, the clusters of illuminating colored markers, the bombarded purgatory, the lemur's descent into hell, the rotting of the bodies. The end of the world stepped out of the wooden panel painting into that evening in May. Seers and heretics had predicted this as they called down from their pyres that the beginning of the end had come and the thrust of fire would soon envelop the whole depraved world. The world deserved its ruin, and the patience of the Lord had come to an end. The tongues of flame that bomber command sent from the sky pushed aside all familiar reality, all false idols. The fire war demanded an account from the Antichrist who appeared before the end of time. In a transcendental city such as Cologne, Cologne was really not an industrial center so much. It was a very spiritual, had a very long spiritual heritage. In a transcendental city such as Cologne, the 1,000-bomber raid had came from the depths of the prophecy of doom. The massacre was the city's oldest myth. In the summer of 1943, the Archbishop's General Curacy posted a notice on the churches. In response, quoting, "In response to suggestions from lay circles, we request that pastors notify the congregations at regular intervals in their proclamations from the pulpit that they can obtain full indulgence during an air raid if they reverently and repentantly recite the quick prayer, 'My Jesus, mercy.'" There was just enough time for three words. They were necessary between June 16th and July 9th when four heavy raids burned the city center to the ground. The second mission took 4,377 human lives and left 230,000 homeless. In 67 minutes, the substance of 1,900 years was liquidated. It burned for 5 days. Subsequent attacks continued to plow the ground like a tractor, taking up where the previous raid had left off. On Saturday, July 10th, survivors gathered for Vespers in the ruins of the Haymarket, which is Haymarket Square, to commemorate their bonds with those who died by ringing all the bells that still existed. In the spring of 1944, the U.S. 8th Air Force joined in the elimination of Cologne with carpet bombing. Like the seven plagues, the entire burden of death lowered itself over the city in seconds. In April, Bomber Command flew a 38-minute raid of refined blast and burn surgery. Omitting the dead tissue in the fields of rubble, the operators were on the lookout for islands of life, continuing this each month until September. So from spring until September, they did these burn and blast surgery raids. And then there were 28 raids in October 1944, making it the most devastating month since the war had started. Over the course of the transportation offensive, sites were set on five precision targets, the Rhine bridges. Barrels of smoke mixture were placed at the embankments and on the streets crossing the Rhine. And when the siren sounded, the bridges disappeared as if under Siegfried's magic helmet. The Rhine districts were transformed into a seething pea soup into which the three raids from October 28th to November 1st pumped 9,000 tons of bombs. St. Geron Church was among those destroyed. It had been expanded into a decagon in the 13th century, built over the original oval from the 4th century. On October 30th, a portion of the northwestern side, 2 axes wide, was rammed in from the vault to the base. In St. Pantaleon, the mortal remains of Empress Theophanu, the Byzantine princess who married Otto II in 972 and was regent of the Holy Empire for 8 years for the underage Otto III, were desecrated. Cologne had become a city with few people and many rats scurrying about the mountains of rubble and gorging themselves on the provisions stored in the cellars. The rat poison had run out. Debris and timber continued to smolder quietly, and the fires crackled on desolate streets. On March 2nd, this is only 1944, ladies and gentlemen, on March 2nd, 858 Lancasters and Halifaxes attacked Cologne for the last 2 times, killing hundreds of people who remained lying on the streets. Thousands fled the city before the U.S. 8th Corps entered at 3:30 p.m. on March 6th. This last March 2nd might have been 45. Sorry about that. The 8th Corps, U.S. 8th Corps entered the city at 3:30 p.m. on March 6th. Of the 768 residents, only 10,000 awaited the liberators. 5% of the old town had been preserved. So 95% of the old town was gone. And can you imagine, of 768 residents of Cologne, at the end, only 10,000 remained in the city to greet the liberators. They didn't greet them. But I have a video on my website about this with a lot of pictures at the time. Well, you know, the filming. And the city is just a total, I mean, it's just, you think it was a total ruin for a long time. I mean, there's nothing there, nothing. And hardly any people, barely. Okay, I was going to read about Bonn, but I don't have time, so I'm going to move ahead to what I think is, I forget the name of, Kaiserslautern, which is down toward the south end of the Rhine, one of the furthest south cities there, not in Germany, but along the Rhine. So the destruction of the 30 Years' War left its mark on Kaiserslautern. But this time it was said the fires would not make it through to the town because it was in a valley and fog often hid the buildings. Nonetheless, tunnels were constantly being dug out on the slopes. Old beer cellars were reinforced, and water from the Siegel Stream and the Lauter River was used to fill reservoirs for extinguishing fires. When in broad daylight around noon on January 17th, 1944, 116 buildings were destroyed or severely damaged and 81 people killed by 2 waves of American bombers, people realized that it was possible. Numerologists are interested in the number 3. 303 times 3 years had passed since the last major conflagration in the 30 Years' War. That had been the second destruction. Would the third one follow during the Third Reich? Feelings of insecurity accumulated each time the siren sounded. People reacted with a start. Going to the tunnels became a race for one's life. The notorious bunker rats no longer dared to leave the shelters, sometimes because they were homeless, sometimes because they were keen on claiming their regular place. With its 66,000 residents, the city was designated a second-order air raid protection site and was thus not eligible for national subsidies to build air raid shelters. The municipality had as many as their funds would allow and as many as the residents could shovel. Protection had to be fought for. Up to August 14th, the air raid sirens had sounded 328 times. On April 23rd, they sounded 8 times within a 24-hour period. The residents were overtired, worn out, and at the end of their tether. On August 14th, 1944, the 8th Air Force returned around midday and dropped combined explosive incendiary munitions on 80 streets. The oppressively hot summer temperatures slowed down the dissipation of the smoke and heat from the fire. The Eckel Furniture Company's huge wood supply in the city center ignited. The flames rose upward, forming a torch that drew in colder air layers from the neighboring forests. The resulting draft fanned the flames. It was that notorious apocalyptic mechanism. Kaiserslautern was surrounded by wood, the city, church, and Reich force. The imperial murder arsonist of, I don't need to read all that, master painter August Nebling observed the bomber's activities from an attic under Betzenberg Mountains. As he watched the rain of fire falling, he thought of the three barrels of turpentine he had stored in his house. The 300 children's beds that had to be painted, and the paint and wood oils. Spur of the moment, I jumped on my bicycle and raced eastward on Barbarossa Strasse, where the Lotz wooden shoe factory was burning fiercely. The bike ride ended at the Eckel Furniture Company. He writes, their wood storage yard had meanwhile become a huge sea of flames that spread to the buildings. Well, you know, I'm going to continue this, ladies and gentlemen. When we get back to the from the break, it's just a short bit more, and I don't want to stop in the middle of this. So when we get back, I'll do this, and then I'll go on to the next part of my program.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
French voters are beginning the process of choosing the next president. Now, there are 10 candidates in the running, including incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy and his main rival socialist François Hollande. The main concern, though, is turnout will be low, all amid discontent over a struggling economy and record unemployment. Let's get the full picture now from RT's Tessa Arcilia, standing by for us live in Paris. So good to see you, Tessa. How is the voting going so far?
Well, it is underway, and as you mentioned, the voter turnout is a big concern here. I mean, people are watching it closely because the numbers could sway the results of round one of this presidential race. We've got early numbers, according to the Ministry of the Interior, about 28% have turned out so far. It's not that bad, but we have to wait for the total because the projection is that up to a third of voters won't actually cast their ballots, and that's because many of the French feel that there really isn't much of a choice. There's no one out there who's giving them real solutions to the problems they're facing, especially with regard to the economy and jobs. And this very disillusionment has given rise to more extreme views, feelings of anti-globalization or anti-immigration, which has also propped up candidates on the far right, such as Marine Le Pen, and on the left, you have Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Well, let's get a bit more insight on exactly what is happening here in France from Barry Lando. He's a journalist and author. Mr. Lando, thanks very much for joining us today. I brought up the issue of the far right and the hard left. Now, this feeling of anti-globalization. Is this a knee-jerk reaction to the problems, or is it here to stay?
No, I think it's here to stay for several years, and I think it's been here for quite a few years also. I think you're finding it all over Europe, and it's a puzzlement among the French. They can't quite figure out what's happened. They've been hard hit, like many other countries in Europe have been, and they're looking for a solution sort of desperately. And unfortunately, the solutions are not going to be easy. So the parties on the right, on the left, the extreme parties are offering much more easy solutions, much more easy targets that people would like to believe in. But as far as the number of abstentions go, one point I think is fascinating is that in the United States, about 50% of the electorate does not vote. That's even in the year when Obama won, 50% didn't vote. So it's not just in France, it's in a lot of countries.
Okay, let's talk about the far right a little bit here. The sentiment of anti-immigration, it has been aligned for a long time, but Nicolas Sarkozy, who's on the center right, has been jumping on this bandwagon. What is this electioneering, or is it a problem that should be given a bit more significance in the country?
It's a problem that should have been given much more importance for the last 10 or 15 years. It's not at all new, and it's true Sarkozy has jumped on the bandwagon now. He's trying to get votes from the far left, from Marine Le Pen, who, of course, has always had that issue going. But yes, our
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm going to continue where I left off reading in the first 25-minute segment, because I was just in the middle of something. And but I want to remind you that we do have listener call-in in the second hour. You can call 1-855-477-2283. Bill Fink will be joining me in the second hour, and we will take calls after it gets going a little bit. So for that, I will now. I'm on to page 255 for those who are interested in the page number, and we're in Kaiserslautern, and this master painter, August Nebling, watched the city on fire, and he remembered he had turpentine and a bunch of wooden beds, 300 wooden children's beds to paint in his house. He got on his bike to go there. And I don't know if it was to get rid of that so it wouldn't burn up the house or what was on his mind. I'm not smart enough to figure that out, I guess. But it says, he ended up at the Eckel Furniture Company who he worked for. And this is what it says. This is his story. Their wood storage yard had meanwhile become a huge sea of flames that spread to the buildings on Schneppbachstrasse. So I rode along Schulstrasse, which was already burning. A bomb exploded 6 meters from me, throwing me through the air against the iron gate of the schoolyard, where I landed unconscious, lying on with my face in the rubble. At the last moment, I was still able to see how the corner building with the Jung's bakery had slid rather close to me. The suction from the bomb blast had torn it apart. After what seemed like a short time, I came to, and besides my general shock, I became aware that I was lying there stark naked, and only my shoes were still intact. All that was left of my clothes were narrow strips of fabric. Covered with blood, I got up. All around me was fire and smoke, which darkened what only 15 minutes earlier had been a sunny summer day. The baker's apprentice from the demolished building next door was lying next to me. Only his foot was twitching. I lifted him up and noticed a large pool of blood underneath him. He had bled to death. 3 meters away, I noticed a dead policeman in the rubble. Author, when Nebling finally crawled home, the inevitable had already happened. The flames were licking 6 feet high out of the windows. Bursts of fire were shooting from the workshop. He said, my brother was trying, to no avail, to extinguish the fire in the shop. Blast bombs suddenly whizzing down from the sky quickly chased us back into the cellar. On the way, my brother collapsed. He suffered a stroke from the shock and died the next morning. Nebling's next thought was of his wife in the air raid cellar. And he writes, but the entrance was blocked by debris from a demolition bomb. It took 5 hours to get the 30 people trapped in this shelter out through the holes in the walls between the cellars. I banged on the basement window, but since the bomb left me totally deaf in my left ear and partly deaf in my right. I couldn't hear any response to my knocking. Extremely weakened, I started back towards Preußenplatz. So many buildings had since caught fire on Schulstrasse that thick mushroom clouds of smoke filled the sky above the city, making it very dark. Dropping to the ground every 15 steps and taking great pains, I was finally able to get back to the square in safety, where the fire brigade picked me up and brought me to the shelter in Barbarossa School. And then the Friedrich says Nebeling died from his injuries in 1949. The route that day from Betzenberg to Barbarossa School was like a simplissimus war novel pressed into 1 hour. The business that was built up with hard work and whose success was made of wood, the reprisal-hungry bomb mixture, the treachery of cause and effect, the senselessness of any and all efforts, the inevitability of the fire, the dying for naught. The annihilating raid on Kaiserslautern was the third one. It was flown by Bomber Command with 909 tons of bombs in the ninth month of the 309th year after the destruction during the 30 Years' War. The third destruction of Kaiserslautern during the Third Reich killed one-third the number of victims that died in the previous one. But all that numerology brings to light is that 3 equals 3 and destruction can be multiplied. Mystics and historians are driven by the same need to make some sense of things, to uncover some pattern to support what is pointless, to justify the massacre with some logic, and give history a reason. History takes a series of paths, each one leading in a different direction. At the beginning and the end, an irresolvable fact remains. A wood factory caught fire, the heat drew in cool air from the nearby forest, causing a storm, and in the end, nothing remained standing. In April 1945, close behind the advancing Allied forces, sociologist Daniel Lerner, a U.S. intelligence officer, had a look at the state of the conquered German cities. He reported that the centers of all them had simply been razed to the ground. The troops could quarter only in residential districts on the outskirts. Lerner continued. Now, you know, I'm reading this part because this is April 45, the end of the war, and a sociologist named Daniel Lerner, which sounds a Jewish name to me, is a U.S. intelligence officer who's been sent to Germany to look over the state of the cities. And he says, because the centers also contain the infrastructure and public utilities, the electricity, water, and gas lines were often interrupted and never did all of them function at the same time. He estimated the general degree of destruction to be 75%, though in some cases 80% or even 90%. Lerner based his observations merely on his external impressions. A month later, another Office of Strategic Services officer, economist Moses Abramovitz, guess who, what race he is, made the same trip and offered more specific findings. In Essen, he noted the total devastation of both center and outskirts. Many streets are still almost entirely obstructed. Some are totally unrecognizable under the rubble. No one at all was still living in the center of Cologne. The industrial grounds, on the other hand, were in better condition. And then from his report, a survey of companies with more than 250 employees in the Dusseldorf area found that only few had been destroyed and the rest were either damaged in part or not at all, according to officers of Rhine Coal Control. According to officers of Rhine Coal Control, the Ruhr mines had hardly been damaged, and the condition of the winding gear and hauling winches was such that they could be back up to almost full production in only a few months. Based on the surprisingly good condition of the Krupp works in the center of Essen and the suburb of Borbeck, this appraisal does not seem unrealistic. In Western Germany, and this is now the author again, in Western Germany, industrial facilities were to a large extent still usable, Abramovich recorded, as it was difficult to destroy pits and steelworks. And then he said, also, the Germans were very successful as regards repairs of the industrial facilities. Well, what I get from that is that they didn't do such a good job at destroying the industry, So I was still there for them when they took over, but they certainly did a fantastic job of destroying all the residential area and as many people as they could. And that seems to me to be their objective, to have been their objective. And it all worked out pretty well for the Allies. And we've been given, you know, we've been given a bunch of stories about it to make it seem different than what it really was and to make their intentions totally different from what they really were. Okay, that is the end of the reading now. Let's see. I keep using up all my time for this particular topic that I want to talk about, but that I also have I'm not too anxious to talk about. But I will say that I've got it spread around so much, I don't want to lose my place. Last week, I'll just start here. Last week, you know, I was talking about, in the second hour, about some things that I think are questionable in Holocaust revisionism. And I mentioned the fellow Black Rabbit of Inlay, who runs the very popular, I think, probably, Winston Smith Ministry of Truth website. And I also talked about the CODO forum and my complaints there. And I have a lot of stuff here, but I'm not going to have time to cover it all. I will say, I'll start here, that because I want to show that I think this Black Rabbit is not on the up and up, and I don't think this website is on the up and up. And it's, a lot of people, I think I said this last week, won't like me saying that, but I did get a couple of emails saying, well, they people were from people who said they were kind of suspicious of it, and they were happy to hear what I had to say, that they thought, you know, you never, when you feel suspicious about something, you think there's just something wrong with you. And yet it usually doesn't happen that way. It's usually there's something to it. But most people do not want to come out and say anything about someone else that they don't even know. And I understand that because I'm having my own trouble with it. But here I go. On April 10th, Black Rabbit wrote on Scrapbook Pages. This is where it started. On Scrapbook Pages blog, he wrote a comment that included this. Some Zionists frequently speak of Hitler as a messenger of God sent to further the work of Zionism. All Zionist activity is directed toward the principal aim of the Nazis, that of Jewish immigration from Germany. And he went on with a little bit more. This is from the a quote from the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. And I wondered what he was up to. So I wrote a comment back to that. I replied to that, and I said these kinds of statements by the Zionist Jews are where the ridiculous idea got started, that Hitler was a Zionist. His whole program, they say, was to help the Jews get to Palestine. He was the founder of Israel. You know, there's a book by that name. But I say he had his own purpose for doing what he did with that, moving Jews to Palestine in the beginning and so on. And to which he replied back and said with some quotes and links, he has a quote from Alfred Rosenberg, Zionism must be vigorously supported in order to encourage a significant number of German Jews to leave for Palestine and other destinations. And he's got this on his blog, too. With you know, his sensational-looking pictures and big headlines and so on. And it's supposed to show that this was National Socialist policy from Rosenberg. And then he's got – and this is where he brought up the Klaus Puhlkin 1976 paper, which I talked about last week. So if you didn't hear that, you'll have to go back to that program and listen to that, because I'm not going to repeat it now. And he linked to a Mark Weber radio program on Nazi Zionist collaboration. This was a recent one, fairly, 2012. So I don't know what would have been there about it, but it just that, you know, he was mentioned. So I have noticed, now let's see, what is this? Oh, he ends up saying to me, I have noticed that both neo-Nazis and Zionists, i.e. most Jews and tens millions of U.S. evangelicals, get very, very angry when people mention the fact that Zionists and Nazis collaborated. I received highly abusive emails from Jews and even more abusive ones from neo-Nazis for writing about it. So I looked at his links and read his stuff and so on. I got even more sure that there was something questionable about this guy. So I wrote then a post on April 12th. These dates are very important. April 12th, I posted at Scrapbook Pages in that same comment section, questioning his sincerity. And I said, I questioned his sincerity. Then he wrote back. He wrote, have you read German historian Klaus Polkin's 1976 paper, The Secret Contacts, which I had, and he recommended it again. And, well, I had read that. Or maybe that was me. This was my post, and I put that down as what he had said. And then I answered, Klaus Polkin is not a historian but a journalist. Well, I went through all that with you last week. So after that, what's important here really is the dates. I wrote to him again, and I said, your style is to sprinkle one or two sentence quotes around without context and send people chasing off after what you want them to read. This is exactly what trolls and agents do. In the same spirit, you say that Abe Foxman takes the same position I do on a Nazi Zionist collaboration. Well, he did say that. He said, do you know that Abe Foxman is kind of interesting that Abe Foxman takes the same position you do on Nazi Zionist collaboration, which means he denies it. Yeah, I deny it, in the way that he puts it, that they're actually really of the same mind working together. So implying that I can't therefore have it right, I say. So I was going on there about the things that he has on his website and what the purpose is, all this Hitler was a Zionist stuff. I found a whole bunch of Hitler was a Zionist posts on his website. And I talked about that, I think, last week. So anyway, he never answered me. Yeah, he disappeared from Scrapbook Pages for a while, but I'm sure he's not actually, he did show up again, but he didn't continue. Now, here's what's interesting. Yesterday, this is probably above here. Okay, yesterday, I go to his website, his blog there, and I find that he has something. I find that there's a post from April 4th that was before our exchange on Scrapbook Pages, which is called Goebbels Calls Hitler's Girlfriend a Jew. It's another one of these anti-National Socialist posts. He's got a picture of Leni Riefenstahl with this black Negro African in Africa, and she was about 100 years old then. But she did go there, and she had this, I don't think she was 100 when she went there, but she was pretty old. But she did have a project there, and she liked these people. They were extremely black. He's got that there, and he says that she was denounced by Goebbels at a party in Germany during the 40s for being a Jew. And he's got a newspaper clipping from the Dallas Morning News on June 14th, 1937, but it originated in Paris, France, June 13th, UP. It was quoting the Paris Soir paper. And, the Paris Soir is notorious for being like, it must have been part of it worked for intelligence or printed things for intelligence agencies, propaganda for the Allies. And it says that Goebbels at a party called Hitler's girl a Jew. And this is, he's referring to Leni Riefenstahl and that they had a 2-year friendship or something and blah, blah. It never happened. It never happened. It's a total lie. But he should know that. But he put this here just this past month on the 4th of April. And he titles it as Hitler in Love with the Jewess. And then he got a comment from someone who didn't like what he did and said this was wartime propaganda, disinformation. And then, now this comment didn't come until April 21st, 2 days ago. And so then on April 22nd, yesterday, ladies and gentlemen, yesterday, he writes under this comment, thanks very much. I found out a while back that it was Jews who started the Hitler's a Jew claims. he found out a while back. When was that? Because he put some links here that in November 2011, last November, he wrote a blog that said, Jew who called Hitler a Jew. And this is supposed to mean that he knew that and he was exposing that or something, which it wasn't. That's not what it was. He was just running another one of these stories that he puts up several a day that a Jew had called Hitler a Jew. It didn't say that Hitler wasn't a Jew. And then he has a second one here. It was a top level Zionist, he says, propagandist who started the Hitler's a Rothschild claim. And he's got another post of his from September last year titled Origin of Hitler Rothschild Rumor. I looked at that and, you know, it's full of a lot of, here's how he does it. He puts all these rumors, all this hearsay, all these lies up. And then somewhere, you know, he doesn't actually endorse them, but he puts it all there and all kinds of links and stuff to this garbagey material on the internet that he sends people to. So you're reading the garbage, even though, you might think, well, this isn't really true, but why is he doing it? Why does he do it? You know, to me, people who are on the up and up don't do things like that. He has a third one that he from January 2011, and he says, it's Jews today who maintain Hitler thought he was a Jew, and it's this story of Hitler, a crazy story about Hitler hating his Jewish father, his father being a Jew, which he wasn't, and how they both hated themselves because they were Jews, and why they're both such sick individuals, and so on and so forth. All of that garbage. So here's the thing, that on April 10th, he's putting this garbage down on Scrapbook Pages blog. I object to it, and I write to him, and I kind of out him on there, saying, you know, you're not on the up and up. There's something wrong with you. This stuff that you're linking to is not good scientific revisionism. It's not good information at all. And then he leaves Scrapbook Pages, but he's still kind of doing this. But finally, when somebody else gets on his blog on the 21st, Sunday. What day was the 21st? Saturday. He then says, oh, okay, you know, I don't really believe this. And he says, I found this out a while back. Now, and he did this just yesterday. So after I came after him, I really do believe that he has been, that I'm the reason for this. But because somebody wrote on Scrapbook Pages blog that they agreed with me on that same comment page. They said, they wrote to him, replied to him and said, you know, I'm with Carolyn. I think you're, there's something wrong with what you're doing here. All through his entire blog, he's always done these anti-Hitler things. Now here on Monday, the 24th of January, 2011, this is the one about the Hitler, the self-hating Jew. You should see what garbage. He's got links to all these Jewish writings, and he writes this baloney that officially Hitler's parents were Catholics, but his father had been an illegitimate child. His grandfather was a Jew. Rumor, whether it was true or not, the rumor haunted him, and, you know, he had it investigated, obtaining evidence that it was true. He didn't have it investigated. Even that story is not true. And then he links at the bottom to all these articles. Here they are. Hitler hated his Jewish father, Hitler's order to suppress his family's Jewishness, Hitler's sister, manager of the Jewish Mensa Club Vienna, Hitler blackmailed over his Jewish grandfather by his nephew. In 1944, the U.S. government suspected Hitler was a quarter Jew and a Rothschild. He says, see also, he wants people to look at these stories. Now, this is all the Jim Condit stuff that I have talked about in the past on other programs. And this Jim Condit stuff also has a Polish Catholic origin. And the Polish Catholics, there is a section of Polish Catholics that are really active in hating Germans in Germany, and particularly hating Adolf Hitler and the Nazis and so on. So they put out this stuff. Now, I don't know who this Black Rabbit is. I don't know if he works for British, for you know, some form of British intelligence that's still upholding the World War II narrative, which they are doing. Why do they have all these stories in the British newspapers, like the Mail and the Telegraph and every one of them, the Mirror? At least once a week, they have a major anti-Hitler or anti-Nazi story. They keep this stuff going. All these lies and innuendos and rumors and some new book that somebody wrote trying to make some money off of it. And so this is all British. Or it could be, I don't know if he's Jewish. I don't know if he's a Polish. I don't know if he's just dumb and stupid. I don't know what he is. But if he's just trying to put on his blog what he thinks people will like and get people to come back, because it's a very shallow kind of blog. And it's got lots of funny pictures or big pictures and kind of shocking type things or entertaining. People go there basically for entertainment. But this fellow said, who wrote on scrapbook pages and called him out on his anti-Hitler stuff all the time, he said, well, you've got a great blog. I wish I could find this quote here before my time is up. Okay. Anyway, he said, you do great work. You've got a great blog. It's just this one part, you know, keep it up. Well, I want to say that he doesn't have a great blog. He doesn't do great work. And people need to look at this. And when somebody is wrong in a part, they're not necessarily right about the other things. All right, I have to wait until we come back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Feature story news in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. U.S. President Barack Obama has unveiled fresh sanctions against the governments of Iran and Syria. He accused President Bashar al-Assad of presiding over unspeakable violence in Syria and said that the widening grip of sanctions will eventually force a change of power in Damascus. Speaking during a visit to Washington's Holocaust Museum, the American leader said the new sanctions will target technology providers who work with the governments of Syria and Iran to enhance their ability to identify protesters and crack down on them.
I've signed an executive order that authorizes new sanctions against the Syrian government and Iran and those that abet them for using technologies to monitor and track and target citizens for violence. These technologies should be in place to empower citizens, not to repress them.
Campaigning is now underway in the second round of the French presidential elections after Sunday's inconclusive first round of voting. François Hollande, the socialist leader, says he's confident that he can now cruise to victory over the incumbent president, Nicolas Sarkozy. But Marine Le Pen of the far-right National Front scored an unexpectedly strong third-place performance, leading many analysts to believe that she's in a strong position to influence the outcome of the second round in 2 weeks' time. FSN's Kate Moody is in Paris for us.
Sarkozy and Hollande will have to court her supporters. Many may abstain rather than vote for a center-right or socialist candidate. For months, polls have tipped Hollande to win the second round, which would make Sarkozy the first incumbent to lose a re-election bid since 1981.
Former U.S. presidential candidate John Edwards has gone on trial in North Carolina, accused of using campaign money to try and cover up the affair he was having with a political aide. Oscar-winning actress Jennifer Hudson has testified in the Chicago trial of a man accused of killing three members of her family back in 2008. If convicted, William Balfour faces a life sentence. U.S. retail giant Walmart allegedly paid millions of dollars in bribes to local officials in Mexico to build and open new shops. According to a New York Times report, investigators working for Walmart found evidence of bribes but failed to report it to law enforcement. From FSN's bureau in Los Angeles, Lindsay Mastis reports.
The watchdog group Transparencia Mexicana says it wants Mexico's government to investigate the bribery allegations. The New York Times said Walmart's own investigators concluded that Mexican and U.S. laws were likely violated by the company's executives in Mexico. Yet Walmart shut down its own internal investigation. Activist groups have alleged that the permit process was rigged for years, and in at least one case said Walmart began building a store without permits. Lindsay Mastis, Los Angeles.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and now we're on to another very controversial topic, and talking about people in the revisionist movement, and Bill Fink is with me, and but I'm asking him to wait a little bit because I need to make a little introduction here because of something I just learned about today. So, you know, I gave us the title for tonight's topic: Perspectives on the Value of Jews in Holocaust Revisionism. It's kind of an umbrella title for something that deeply concerns me. It might not be the best title, but anyway. The first thing that we need to keep in mind is that every revisionist is an individual. There's some noise in the background. I don't know. Every revisionist is an individual. I don't know what that is. There's no such thing as all revisionists agree with this, that, or the other thing, you know, fill in the rest. The background for tonight's topic is an exchange of comments to a short piece. Why are all these little blurpy things going on? Whoever's on the line, it's too early to have somebody on the line. The background for tonight's topic is an exchange of comments to a short piece I wrote at Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World about Wiesel's reaction to the Günter Grass controversy. The article is titled, Elie Wiesel Condemns Günter Grass for Going Too Far, if you want to go there and look at it. And the comments are from Jet Rucker, who is part of the Kodo family, I would say, and Germar Rudolph. And then I replied to each one of them. And I would not have brought this. I wanted to discuss the philosophies behind the comments. But today I discovered that Germar Rudolph has a new website, and lo and behold, he blogged about this comment exchange between us and about our different views. And I'm wanting to take just a few minutes to speak about Germar, who has really honored me by replying to and acknowledging my Elie Wiesel site. And I have the highest regard for Germar. And in fact, I corresponded with him some while he was in prison. And I learned at that time that he was a little less radical than I was and had a little different views. And now what has come out now is just exactly the same as what he expressed then. So he's a very consistent person. He doesn't, when he says that he hasn't changed his his thoughts, his opinions from the time he wrote his introduction to dissecting the Holocaust until now, I can certainly believe that, because his views have remained very consistent, views that I learned about back then until now. So what I'm going to do now is to go to his website, where he has GuillermoRudolph.com, ladies and gentlemen. And he does have only a few posts, three, and one of them is titled Gunter Grass, Elie Wiesel, Carolyn Jaeger, and I. And he writes about this exchange that we had, because it started with Jet Rucker, who found some fault with a paragraph in that article about Elie Wiesel and Gunter Grass, where I said that the Jews and the Germans can never reconcile. He finds this rather, you know, really sad and wrong, and the wrong kind of attitude to have. And he mentioned that Gunter, Guillermo Rudolph has a different idea, and he hopes that their idea will carry on, will be the one that proves to be true. And so I responded to him, Jet, and then I got a comment from Guillermo Rudolph, which I was very pleased to see, and I posted that, and then I responded to that, and now Gunter is writing about it on his blog, and he says here, he repeats what he wrote there. He repeats part of what I wrote, the first one, and then he says, Carolyn has again posted her comments about it, but I will not reply there again, as it would distract from the original posting's topic. Let me say here only that, although this is really about whether Jews and Germans can reconcile, whether that is a desirable thing, and for me, the difference is that for me, I do not find reconciliation between Jews and Germans a desirable thing. I don't find reconciliation really between Jews and any white European peoples or Americans or any of us to be a particularly good thing when it comes to the Holocaust, because I don't believe that it would ever be in our interests. But they see it differently. So he says, let me say here only that although reconciliation does not mean that two parties forgive each other, as Carolyn states, it does not mean that any of them forgets the past. Our history is part of our identity, which we should never forget. Also, I can forgive a person or a group of persons without them forgiving me in return. Although that is not called reconciliation, he says, it still is a necessary act of emotional hygiene. If we keep holding grudges or even hating others, we might not do harm to them, but we sure do harm to ourselves, because the key to happiness is not grudging and hating, quite to the contrary. That is my outlook on life, he says. I know that's true. Hence, my attitude toward the oppressors and persecutors and their kin isn't primarily based on tactical considerations, as Carolyn imputes. I said that this was, he was saying these positive things as a tactic to kind of make the readers more open to his revisionist arguments, you know, by showing that he had nothing personal against the Jews, that he wanted to be friends with Jews and with Holocaust believers and so on, wanted to work things out. He just wants a debate. And here we come to everything that CODA represents, and which is that if we could just have an open debate, and I'm not against debate, of course, but I don't have as much high hopes for debate, because it turns out that people won't debate. They don't debate. They have their own views, and they don't change, and they're not open. Any debate, any Holocaust revisionist debates between believers and non-believers have been totally disastrous. So he says that as to a past and a possible future German-Jewish symbiosis or any other such constellation, here too focusing on the positive aspects of the past to envision a better future would be helpful. One thing is certain, if we don't try, we won't succeed. Well, you know, that sounds very positive. I certainly could not say, oh, no, I want to be negative, and I'm not going to be open to anything like that, although I just kind of said that. But it is because I don't believe that the other side would do does anything in good faith. I don't believe they do anything in good faith. And I think that I have a history on my side, and I also have Bill Fink on my side. And we're not here to argue against Guillermar because, you know, he's not here, but to just discuss this topic. I thought about asking Guillermar, but it was too short a time, and I didn't think he would certainly come on, maybe not at all, certainly not on such short notice. So Bill is here to help me talk about what I wanted to talk about anyway, and that is basically what the title says, you know, can we include Jews in revisionism, and can we include Jews, you know, as partners in our countries, like Guillermar and Jet Rucker are saying. So hello, Bill, and thank you so much for waiting.
Hello, Carolyn, and thank you for having me, and praise Christ. Okay. I would definitely disagree with Rucker and with Guillermar Rudolph. And I would, if you'd like, let me make a few comments I find that are important to
sure,
make.
Sure, you can make your opening, make your statements there. Go ahead.
I read Dissecting the Holocaust some years ago. I like Guillermar Rudolph. I believe he is a good man. I believe he's honest. And years ago when I read Dissecting the Holocaust, I dismissed his mistakes concerning the Jews as those of a secular idealist who was basically unlearned in Jewish world history, in the Jewish role in world history, which continues to subvert, to be a clear subversive force in all Western culture and to this very day. Rudolph continues to make statements such as, where he talks about the relationships of Jews and Germans prior to 1933, he talks about it with glowing approbation and as if it was a utopian society until the election of Adolf Hitler. And that's a bad, serious mischaracterization. And Rudolph continues to make these statements, and he's not a true historian, and that's really his Achilles heel. He also seeks to correct the dialogue around those certain events of World War II, with what history proves to be an eternal enemy to Western culture. And in reality, that enemy does not care for the truth. That enemy only cares for its own position in society. Rudolph speaks of 18th and 19th century history between Germans and Jews as he's some sort of dreamy idealist, and he draws a totally false picture of that history. And it's hard to summarize the history of a century without oversimplifying it. And the 19th century was a very complicated one. Nesta Webster, in her book World Revolution, presents a very well-documented, and she's not the only source, but she presents a very well-documented and convincing case that the Jews of Europe supported and promoted the Prussian and important Jews in Europe supported and promoted the Prussian nobility to the hegemony at the expense of all the other principalities. And she also presents evidence that Prussian agents, as well as their Jewish Illuminist cohorts, helped to launch the French Revolution, which brought the leftist Jacobins to power. Webster cites that Benoît Mélan, a famous socialist, admitted that the substance of the Communist Manifesto had come down through secret societies and the mostly Jewish Illuminists of Europe. Karl Marx only codified that substance. He didn't write the Communist Manifesto. That revolution was he codified the Communist Manifesto in time for the 1848 revolution, and that revolution was planned. It was planned by Jews, and it was going to happen in any event. And the Communist Manifesto was only its published guidebook. That's all it was. The goals of the Communist Manifesto are the goals of Judaism all along. Today, we have those planks of the Communist Manifesto, which are Jewish in nature, implemented throughout the entire Western civilization. That is not a mistake. That's the work of Judaism. As Webster also illustrated, Robespierre anticipated all of Marx's writings. He used the device of a class war. It was part of the overt plan of the Jacobins, the radical leftists in the French Revolution, to use class as a tool in order to overthrow the French nobility. They also had other Marxist planks like the denial of the rights of inheritance and other Marxist so-called Marxist philosophies built into their and into their French Revolution, into their ideals. Robespierre and many of the Jacobins all had in common a Jesuit education, a great number of them. With the success of the French Revolution, the Jacobins instituted an atheistic state religion in France in the place of Christianity, as Jews do in every single revolution. With the fall of the Jacobins, they achieved revenge by supporting Napoleon, who in turn emancipated Jews in France and wherever else he could throughout the rest of Europe. But there was a Webster quotes at length a Jew named Piccolo Tigre, who was an Illuminist. He was a member of the Illuminati. And Webster quotes him as having written in 1822, among other things, a letter describing the methods of the Illuminati and their operations through secret associations. And it's spelled out. And it's very well documented. And also the Jewish plan to reduce man to an economic being and direct him into the pursuit of pleasures and lusts rather than household cares and cares for their family. And it's a major plank of the communist revolution to destroy the bourgeois family so that they could liberate our women from their clothing for the most part. Yeah, you know, during this period, mostly Jewish propaganda and social engineering reduced the concept of European man to a base economic entity. Capitalist Jews believed they could control Europe and the world through mercantilism, and they sold this idea to German nobles, and Hitler renounced this idea very frequently in Mein Kampf. Communist Jews sold the idea that a working man should be his own master, and thereby all were enslaved by a handful of apparatchiks wherever communists came to power. And they were always Jewish apparatchiks. In any event, man is reduced to a consumer, and we see that in modern life today. Today, the Jews finally won out because we're all communists, basically. That's the end result of all the Jewish revolutions, not only through the 19th century, but through the 20th. The sexual revolution, the feminist revolution, all these so-called revolutions we've had here in America have worked towards the same idea of a Jewish world utopia, and we have total degeneracy throughout the entire once Christian Western civilization at the hands of the Jews. The Jews were behind Marxism. They were behind every revolution in Europe, every revolution, social revolution, and revolution in the United States. Wilhelm Marr, in the 1870s, he wrote about the defeat of Germanism to Judaism as if it were an accomplished fact. He knew it was an accomplished fact by 1879, and he professed as much. This was not cooperation between Germans and Jews. This was warfare and social agitation until the Jews finally got their way.
Well, I have some things to say about that period that actually fits in with what you're saying, although it's expressed a little bit differently. So when you're done, I'll go through that.
Well, basically, in the Weimar period of Jewish hegemony over Germany, and that's what it was, Adolf Hitler and all the men around him saw the transformation of Germany into a culturally debauched state at the hands of the Jews. It was rife with venereal disease, pornography, drug use, and it was New York. It was what New York became in the 1960s and 70s and the rest of urban America. And look at our urban centers now. They're destroyed. And sadly, Hitler's resistance to that was futile, but that's what Hitler was fighting. Hitler didn't dislike the Jews simply because they had a different religion. And there was no such thing as a Jewish-German utopia ever, anywhere. And Germar Rudolph, I'm sorry to say that his belief that the Germans and the Jews had some sort of utopia is contrary to all German Jewish
history. I think what he's saying, Bill, is that it's not, you can't say it's all Jews. What they object to, both of them, is me making a blanket statement that Jews and Germans cannot and should not try to coexist together, and that goes with Jews and other groups too, but particularly for me, because I'm more concerned with the German nature, and I think Jews and Germans are opposites and are not moving along the same track at all, and the Jews are bad for Germans. But what they object to is not that there would be that there were a lot of bad Jews, or that a lot of this stuff is not happening and didn't happen, but that it's not all Jews. And that's the argument. That's the thing that most people, have a problem with. And that this is where we come to this this difficulty in communicating, because they'll say, well, it's not all Jews. You know, before we go on, I there was one thing I was going to say about Germar's blog, and I'm back on this page again, so I want to say it and then leave this page.
I would like to respond to that real quick.
Well, just hold on, and then we will. We'll get right back to it. He wrote when he copied my my comment on his blog, the comment that I wrote on my blog. He wrote after it, typos corrected. He's indicating that there were typos, which he corrected. And I thought, gee, what typos did I have? So I probably did, I'm not immune to typos. So I went and looked at my original on Ellie Wiesel page, and I looked at it, and it was everything was exactly the same as he has here. I didn't see a single difference, not a dot different. So I wondered, and I did write to him and ask him, but I don't know if I've gotten an answer yet. But why it says here typos corrected, because it's a little bit of a bad reflection on me, kind of, which it doesn't seem to be the type of thing Germar would do, and I don't think he did it on purpose. I don't know what the misunderstanding is there. So I did wanted to mention that, because I'm directing people to this page at germarrudolph.com, and then up in the upper corner you see the three blogs for April, and this one is called Gunter Grass, Ellie Wiesel, Carolyn Jaeger, and I. All right, and I do thank Germar once again for that and for his attentions, because I think a lot of them, as you do, Bill. So go ahead with your response to what I just said. That's a really interesting point, I think, and important.
Well, I have a few things that we could fit them in.
Well, I want to continue with the history before we finish with that, because I did some research on that too. So which would you rather do first?
Well, let me respond to the fact that it's not all Jews. You're right.
Okay.
Not
all right.
Jews were Illuminati. But all Jews were had antipathy towards Christian society, and no Jews stood against it. Not all Jews were profiteers in the Weimar Republic. Not all Jews could get bank loans from banks outside of Germany so that they could buy up all the German property they bought up in the Weimar Republic at dirt prices, at dirt cheap prices. But no Jews stood against it. Not all Jews were participants in the 1960s revolutions, social revolutions in America. But very, very few Jews stood against it. I think I could think of one right now, and that's probably Barry Goldwater. It's that they have all supported these things. They do not resist the decadence that has progressed in all of Western civilization in 200 years. They do not stand against it. And most of them, that they push that forward, and they consistently support those things.
Well, that's true. I agree. They don't stand up. If they don't think the same, if they can be people who would be more on our side, say, I guess that's not the way they'd want to put it, but then if they were more open to changes, they should be doing something about their own people who are behaving so outrageously terrible, and they don't, and that's very true, and that is the thing that these people need to answer to. If they're not all the same, why do they all follow along in the same pattern? Speaking of these, this history, there was a reform movement. Here's what I learned, that after 1850 or so, Jews gained attention academically, or the, you know, they started making a place academically by writing manuals and compiling dictionaries of the Hebrew language, concordances of the Bible, lexicographical works to the Talmud and other of their religious texts, and religio-philosophical literature they cultivated. So all of this gave them a place in as kind of scholars, and the German scholarly world was very interested in all of this, you know, they, in the Hebrew language and the history of the Jews as they saw it and so on. And so this is where they got going. And then some, Zacharias Frankel, he's just a name, but I'm sure he didn't do it all by himself, but he was a leader in initiating the, a reform movement for religious worship, so that they would, the whole idea was to get them to assimilate more in, as Germans. And he introduced congregational singing, and then they had, but now here we get to the interesting part. Now, they began forming public institutions of the Jewish communities. This is from Wikipedia. And, you know, it's all written by Jews. So it's written, you know, in the interest of how Jews want to present it. And so they call it public institutions of the Jewish communities. It really means Jewish institutions. And they promoted this, and these Jewish institutions that they were forming promoted Jewish solidarity. They weren't promoting how to integrate in with Germany. They weren't promoting how to become German. They were trying to act like they would appear more German, appear more acceptable to the German people. But they were very concerned with keeping their Jewish solidarity. And they also, this is also the object of the Jewish press, which they created, and this one guy, Ludwig Philipson, in 1837 founded the Allgemeine Zeitung der Judenhums, you know, a Jewish newspaper, and they, from then on, had all their own press, their own newspapers. Well, I've been brought into.
Well, one thing that you may not
know. Well, you're going to be cut off, Bill. We'll be back in a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The UN is bolstering its observer mission to Syria as multiple reports continue that the teetering ceasefire is being violated by both sides. The rebels' political leaders still want a UN-backed military intervention, but as Atizaxana Boyka reports from Damascus, the public have no appetite for foreign interference.
Almost everyone in Syria these days is in opposition to something, ready to lash out at opponents at any moment. And 76-year-old Mafid Mohammed is in opposition to that. He says Syrians are so worked up about politics that it's become difficult to make people smile. But he found a way.
I like dancing in the street, and I like the reaction it produces in people. I feel free this way.
Yet even he can't stay away from politics. When I ask him about his biggest concern, he says Syria should not dance to somebody else's tune.
We don't need any countries meddling in our affairs. No NATO here.
While the prospect of a Libya-style intervention seems ever less likely, the militarized opposition and their supporters are still asking for arms.
All we want from Annan and the presidents of other countries is that they support us in our cause. We, the rebels, want to get armed.
While the rebels may have caught all the media attention, the Syrian opposition speaks with many voices. It's often faulted for being disorganized and fragmented, but there is a surprising unity when it comes to the issue of military intervention.
Military intervention? No, it's destructive.
This opposition activist says he was detained and mistreated by the security services. And while he is calling on Bashar al-Assad to leave Syria's political scene, he says the armed groups should do the same.
They are working together now in order to achieve the end, the same end.
Unlike him, Abdulaziz is not afraid to go public with his views. He just returned back from Moscow, where the opposition delegation tried to persuade the Russian authorities to put more pressure on the Assad regime. He says not all powers mediating the Syria crisis are really helping.
You know, all the world now says that we are supporting Iran's plan. Well, we know for sure that some of the states are not supporting that plan. And some are trying to apply some sabotage. And if that happens, I mean, Iran's plan did not succeed, well, it will be a very dark era. The Syrian people will suffer too much.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, Carolyn will be here in a minute. I have something to say. Rudolf, Gerhard Rudolf said that Christianity gives Judaism credence, and without it, the Jewish Stone Age religion would long since have disappeared. And I have an issue with that.
Hello.
Where Judaism thrived in the pagan world for centuries, it may be the mainstream churches which give Jews credence. But Christ was the world's foremost anti-Jew. The Romans placated the Jews.
I'm back, Bill. So can I finish? I don't want to go all the way back to the Romans too much, but I would like to finish what I started, and I would like to give out. I'm sorry. Obviously, my Skype dropped. I never know when it does. I think it's other people drop. I'm sorry about that. But I want to give out the phone number one more time, and that is 1-855-477-2283, listeners, if you want to call in during this half hour. Now, before you go out with that part, Bill, I want to just continue here showing how the Jews were not trying to, what's the word, the A word, trying to get into the German society. They were trying to just take advantage of the German society, get themselves into powerful positions. So now they had they had their newspapers, and then it says that they were successful, and this is in the Jewish Wikipedia. So this is the way they present it, because you know it's supposed to have been very good. They were able to preserve a certain unity of religious opinion and conviction among the Jews by the things that they did, by all of these associations, with the gratifying result of unity of action for the common good. Now, here they created societies for the cultivation of Jewish literature, and they founded associations of teachers, rabbis, leaders, and congregations. So they had Jewish associations for everything, and this is how they do it, as we know. You know, they started forming all these Jewish associations once they are emancipated and they have the right to do so. And they multiply and they have all of their people belonging to one or another of them. And they're giving out the Jewish solidarity kind of message. And they have, in this way, they have more influence in society than the actual real members of the society. And they herd their own people into the way that they want. And so this is how it happened. This is how it happens. And then we have the Revolution of 48, the 1870s, and all that stuff. And then, here it says in the 1880s, in 1870s, anti-Semitism, it says, was fueled by the financial crisis. Well, the Panic of 1873, it was also called the Long Depression. But don't these financial crises always come about? They're always engineered by Jews in the background. Again, they're going to say, well, not all Jews, just those bad Jews. Okay, well, those financial Jews were engineering this. And there was also scandals. And in the 1880s, there was the arrival of masses of Ostjuden, or the Jews from the East. They're fleeing from Russia. And so they're all coming into Germany. And so naturally, there are nationalists formed, and Wilhelm Marr introduced the term anti-Semitism, and he founded the Anti-Semitic League, and all these Volkish, there was the Volkish movement, which started before 1900, long before Adolf Hitler was doing anything. And they viewed Jews as part of a Semitic race that could never be properly assimilated into German society. And they were very strong, but particularly in the South, South Bavaria and so on. But then in 1912, think about this year, 1912, the Reichstag elections, during those elections, the Volkish movement, right-wing parties, suffered a defeat, a temporary defeat, which paved the way for World War. And so was all this engineered? Probably. And then we had World War One, and then after that, we know what happened.
Well, it was absolutely engineered. The Jews of England were competing with Germany for global trade. They saw a united Germany as a threat to English hegemony. And the Germans were building a railroad to the Orient through Turkey, and the Turks were their allies at the time, and the Jews manipulated the Turks into the war with Germany so that they could take the Levant and Palestine and the Middle East. And they took advantage of that with the Balfour Declaration, which turned many of the Jews in Germany against Germany. It was absolutely engineered. Hitler.
Okay. Well, we agree with that. Well, then what do we do about the idea that is the big argument that it's not all Jews, and we can find these good Jews and we can work with them, and to what end? What end are we going to work to with the few good Jews that we find? Are they going to change the other Jews?
So that we're convinced that we need Jews. That there's a lot of problems. First, the Jews also in the 19th century began appointing themselves and getting their fellow Jews appointed into positions of Christian scholarship. And many of the so-called higher critics, the mm-hmm. higher German critics of the Christian Bible, were actually Jews.
That's true. That I think that was in that part that I was covering, but I didn't have time to go into it all. They were doing Jewish religious scholarship, but also all of it. It was all thought to be the same.
So
you know,
no matter
it was
what,
all the
you
same.
Have to get
yeah.
a Jewish perspective.
Yeah,
and the Bibles that created the American evangelical movement and the modern, not the traditional, but the modern Southern Baptists, what were and Yankee Baptists, what were the Bullinger Bible, which is based on the Masorah. Bullinger was a very, very close personal friend of Theodore Herzl, and he based his Christian Bible on the notes from the Jewish Masoretic text. And the Masorah and the Kabbalah, and it's evil
yeah.
as far as I'm concerned.
That's all mentioned in this Wikipedia article. Now here's something else from there that is a sentence that was taken from that it was almost word for word what Germar put in his introduction, And I would like to talk a little more about that, but it looks like we're running out of time. That original introduction to the dissecting the Holocaust. But it says here that the Jews experienced a period of ostensible legal equality from 1848 until the rise of Nazi Germany. In the opinion of historian Fritz Stern, and this is in Germar's introduction, by the end of the 19th century, what had emerged was a Jewish-German symbiosis where German Jews had merged elements of German and Jewish culture into a unique new one. Really? Is that right? Fritz Stern? Who is Fritz Stern? Isn't he Jewish?
Jews conquered Germany, and they did it through mercantilism and through subversion. And Wilhelm Marx could recognize it.
Yeah, but
Hitler recognized
it. You know, he's considered to be an anti-Semite extremist. So, I'm just trying to take this from a point of view of the way the majority of people look at it. But, you know, it says here, as Walter Rathenau found out, he was another Jew who became somebody important. Even in 1905, there was hardly any chance of a Jew receiving a judgeship. Well, why should the Jews be judges in Germany? I really wonder why. But then it goes on to say, and even then, only if the Jewish candidate renounced his faith and converted to Christianity. So they're busy, you know, converting to Christianity, which is, we should not depend on that. We should not say, well, you have to convert, because they don't really convert. But my point is that they were not satisfied. No matter how much more they got, you know, they got all kinds of things they never had before, but then they wanted to be the judges. You see, then the next thing, they want to be the president. They're never satisfied. They always want more.
A lot of the Jesuits were converso Jews, and they were responsible for instigating the 30 Years' War against Germany and wiping out a third of Germany. And they were responsible for that. That was their initiative. That was their agitation. The Jews, Rudolf ignores the fact that there were many problems between Christians and Jews. He's blaming today's problems on Christian Zionists. Well, Christians and Jews have had problems for 2,000 years. And the Jews have been they've had antipathy for Christian civilization and Western civilization for 2,000 years. And the basic paradigm that people like Rudolf think with is wrong, because why should an alien people come into another nation's governance and among another nation's people and expect any civil rights and expect any judgeships and positions?
All right. Very good, Bill. We've got a caller, Frank, from Pittsburgh. He's a good caller. Hello, Frank. Are you there?
Oh, yes, I am. Interesting conversation. The one thing about the mentality of the Jewish element is, as you pointed out just as I came on, they have a rancor and a disdain. They're very hostile toward the groups around them. And to a large extent, you always hear them kind of whining about the fact that they've been discriminated against based on some notion that people are holding or the Christians resent them for the crucifixion of Christ. And it's really just sort of a misdirection that they put out there. You won't find a more ethnocentric group of people than the Jews. And whatever it is with their psyche, or however it is that they almost have this sort of instinctive way of working together, and sort of never saying what they mean or trying to make some argument of using that argument to move things in a different direction. Case in point, they always try to act like they were the most high-minded people for social justice, when in fact really all they ever tried to do is divide and conquer. They've never assimilated. And even within their own communities, like in Hebrew schools and in the Jewish camps where the little kids go, if you could ever hear some of the rhetoric and some of the poison that they fill their heads with, it would just it would just knock you over.
Exactly, exactly. It's really
what
it's
they
shocking.
Really do is they reverse assimilate, right? The Jews assimilate, but it's a reverse assimilation. That they suck in people from the host communities to become Jews and make their half-breed children Jews. And they go on thinking like Jews.
What they do in a lot of cases, though, if you're outside the group, they never let you in, but they have a way of corrupting everything around them. And even going back into the 19th century, they would corrupt local officials through Europe. And even, fast forward to 21st century America, you can see the neoconservatives, and even with this sort of new hatched kind of entertainment / news media that we have. I reference Fox Cable News as one of them. People like Sean Hannity and people like Bill O'Reilly, they're as Gentile as you can get, but with attractive salaries and high profile media positions, they've corrupted them, and they've sort of told the Jewish line, even though they're selling out their own people.
Now, Frank, what do you say about the not all Jews thing? Because you're talking about the Jews as a group right now. You're saying the Jews that.
Yes, and I will. I'll always say that, and this is why. Because when you listen to, again, the high-minded Jews that, you know, never like people to generalize groups and always say, well, you know, it's not all black people that are on drugs, or it's not all Mexican people that are illegal aliens. You know, you have to judge everybody as an individual. Well, let me tell you something. When you listen to the way the Jews talk, they always generalize the white non-Jew. Ask yourself this, okay? If they actually believe that you can't generalize everybody and say, well, it's not all people that are bad, then why is it that reparations are being paid by people that did nothing to them? Just based on the fact that, like Germany, I mean, I've never seen a country that's really more limp and really has really no backbone, is post-World War II Germany, and to continue to pay reparations. And when you listen to...
Well, they continue to insist on their guilt. I mean, they're forced into the worst possible positions. It's pathetic. Oh, and I would like to mention that... in this respect, well, I don't have much time, so I'll do it now. That picture that I put, or did I already mention that on my announcement, and will be on the with the archive of this program, of that horrible Holocaust monument in Germany, almost 5 acres in central Berlin, right close to the in the tourist area, right close to the Reichstag and the Brandenburg Gate, just a shockingly ugly. 5 acres of god awful in prime real estate that they have done this to the Germans. This cannot be. This is not cooperation and coexistence and so on. This is hatred. This is hatred to put up something that horrible. To
bombing that monument would make it an improvement.
Well, it's. You know, and it's falling apart. I mean, it's starting to crack, but I guess they'll repair it. I mean, I'll just try to real quick say this. When I was there, I was not going to go to it. I didn't know that I couldn't avoid it. I was at the place where place where the bunker had been, and they had a marker there and so on. You know, the Berlin bunker at the end of the war and so on, right where the Reichschancellery was. And so then I'm on my way to the Brandenburg Gate. It's morning and the Reichstag and over that area. It was only a couple blocks away. And I start to walk and I look and I say, what is this? And there I am staring at this horror, right there in front of me. And you know, you can't avoid it. It was just, I just couldn't hardly believe how awful it was.
Well, the Jews also, he mentioned Holocaust reparations. The Jews just extorted Lithuania for tens of millions of dollars from Jewish property losses during the Nazi and Soviet regimes. And that is a blatant, I don't know, injustice, historical injustice. It really is. That's incredible.
Yeah,
yes, it is.
I'm always skeptical of, and I guess maybe I shouldn't be, but like this Brother Nathaniel Kapner and, you know, and a few others, although they put some interesting things out there. I just, until you really see a little more broad-based scrutiny of self-scrutiny from the Jewish community, I mean, I really look with skepticism at all of them. This whole thing with the white guilt and their ranting about social justice and looking at what they've done. And the other thing, too, that I think is interesting is, I mean, they're kind of playing their last cards. People are wising up to them.
Well, people like Kapner, and then this Ministry of Truth Winston Smith website, what they have in common is that they're very showy. They're easy to look at. They're entertainment geared, you know. And it's not difficult to comprehend what they're saying. They make a lot of pictures, a lot of, you know, they put a lot of montages together and so on. And it's geared for people who don't have to think too hard. And I just wonder if this is the process of those who understand how to reach the public via the internet, via the truth movement and so on, and put out their misleading stuff, because they all have this. And to me, the sign is always anti-Hitlerism. To me, there's something wrong when they constantly go back to that. Kapner's not as bad, but he brings some of that up sometimes, too.
Well, the thing about the Hitler thing is it's almost to the point where the scrutiny of Hitler, I mean, anytime you hear it now, even people that are sort of indifferent to the topic are beginning to size it up, is bogus. I've heard everything from Hitler was a homosexual, to Hitler was bipolar, to Hitler was Jewish, to Hitler was really working with the Rothschilds, to Hitler was, Hitler was that.
Yeah, he had venereal diseases and this and that. You're right. While we still have time, let me throw this in here because it does fit. I did want to mention that in Guillermo Rudolph's, dear Guillermo, in this introduction to his book Dissecting the Holocaust, which he says he still stands by, it is called A German Jewish Vision of the Future. And he has some links which I find a little bit questionable, but one of them is really questionable, and it is to Dietrich Bronder's book, Before Hitler Came. Of course, the book is in German. He was a German Jew, naturally, a school teacher who wrote this book. It is full of this kind of smears and hatred about all the National Socialists, lie after lie. And I was really surprised when I saw that, because I had never read this. I had read other Rudolph books, but not this one. And it says, for an outline of Jewish contributions to modern German society prior to World War II, see Dietrich Bronder, Bayor, Hitler, you know, in German, and then, I thought, why would he use that? Because it was useful. Because he's trying to show, you know, that a good side of Jews, and obviously this book showed all these German, Jewish contributions to German society while it was attacking all the National Socialists. But it's a scumbag book. This book was used by the guy who wrote, Hitler, Founder of Israel, which is another scumbag book. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that this, Black Rabbit puts on his website. All kinds of this sort of stuff. But he mixes in, better stuff with it. You know, I mean, you know, he's very anti-Jewish on there, though. It's total anti-Jewish. So all the anti-Jewish people like to go to that website, and then they get a bunch of oddball stuff. So that's what I wanted to get in there.
Yeah, Bill, skeptical of those kind of sites.
Yeah, I'm just trying to tell people they should be.
Yeah. The thing about it, too, is somebody's done a great job. They've taken Mein Kampf and they've put it on YouTube. A gentleman's reading it in English. And anybody, regardless of how you feel about the Second World War or National Socialism or whatever, everybody owes it to themselves to listen to at least the first half of the book, because everything that Hitler touches on, I mean, it's very eye-opening, and you can make a lot of comparisons to, you know, his grievances to what was going on. I mean, you can see a lot of similarities to what was happening in his world to really what's happening in our world today. And it still astounds me how dumb people are that buy into the notion that Hitler was trying to conquer the world and that he just used the Jews as a scapegoat, and they were a convenient scapegoat, and it was everything he was doing was baseless, and he knew it. For people that don't really have any kind of an understanding of communism and the role communism was playing in Europe at that time, I mean, we ended up, the United States fought a war basically with the Soviet Union, and then we ended up fighting a Cold War for 50 or 60 years following that. And Hitler was really everything, you know, Hitler and national...
Bill, do you have some last-minute words?
Well, no, I'm just, you know, it's... I don't want to keep on grinding on Germar, and I just wish that he would stick to Holocaust revisionism and his expertise, and he does just well there. I really love the guy for the work he does with that, and he should stay out of history until he studies it.
Well,
that's my closing remark.
Okay. Well, we all study things differently because we're looking to present a different perspective. And that's why I use that word in the headline for this book, for this program. Well, 15 seconds. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I hope we got something across tonight. It's been a kind of a patchwork show. There's never enough time to give everybody the time that they deserve. So I thank you for listening. Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much. Thank you, Frank, and from Pittsburgh. And good night, listeners. Until next week.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.